nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
So thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to present this material to you. The title is Engineering at the Nanometer Scale. Is it a new material or a new device? And to me, that's a very important question to ask, and because it really bridges areas. So why is this important? Well, in a sense, nanoelectronics has arrived in a big way, meaning this is a chart taken from the Intel website. Today's processors have a billion transistors on them, 1 billion little switches, all right, on a very small area. So that means you have to pack a lot of things into a chip, and that literally happens on the nanometer scale. These are some devices that are now quote-unquote old. This is a 90 nanometer node, and you look at this device, and it almost looks like an X-ray of a piece of bone out of your hand or something, right? It's not necessarily what you expect a semiconductor device to look like anymore. If you look at the 35 nanometer node, it looks even stranger still. And that is coming down the line in a few years. And people use different dielectrics now, and they resolve basically the atomistic order and disorder of a silicon substrate. And they're talking about FinFETs, so they're putting a fin as a gate over sort of what looks almost like a nanowire type transistor. And then really going out, the Intel site actually shows research published by Charles Lieber's group in 1998. Those look almost like needle pins, right? But they're on a nanometer scale, so can you make transistors out of that? So what these things have in common is really that there is material variations on the 3D scale on the nanometer scale, right? Yet, we think of them as devices, right? But you guys in material science might think of them as new materials because they certainly don't grow like that in nature. You really have to work very hard to make these things happen. What you also have to work hard in is trying to understand these things. So nanoelectronics as such is not a really new thing. It hasn't just started when President Clinton started the Nano Initiative in 2000. This has been going on for quite a while. And one class of devices that has been looked at extensively are quantum dots. So I'm going to spend a lot of time of this talk on quantum dots, and then I'll talk about nanowires, and then I'll talk about NanoHub, which offers these simulation services for users. All right, so the question now to me is, how can you model such complicated devices, maybe even with one simulator? So to me, the answer is in NeMo 3D, which stands for Nanoelectronic Modeling Code. The goal of this is to start to model realistic structures that might contain millions of atoms, model each atom with a set of atomic orbitals, map them into a real structure, and then compute eigenstates and transport on these large-scale systems that might extend over 20 nanometers or so, and then map them into sensors or computing arrays and devices. Now, the problem that you have at the nanometer scale is that really structure is not a jelly of material anymore. The atomistic nature of it becomes evident. There's devices that are 10 atoms wide. Right? You can't even conceive of saying, well, this is just a continuum material anymore. So you have to deal with the atomistic order of these systems, and you have to do the quantum mechanics. So there's really two ways of doing that for realistically large devices. You can use pseudopotentials or local orbitals. And the devices that I'm interested in are finite in size. They have edges, they have surfaces. In other words, they're not infinitely periodic. When you are infinitely periodic, then plane waves are a great way to analyze things in quantum mechanics. But if you have edges and surfaces, plane waves are not necessarily the greatest way to go about it. And local bases are, in my opinion, the better approach. So that's what we use. We need to have millions of atoms, so we need to also consider how would we compute that, and generally we need to do that on a parallel computer. It will not run on a single CPU. And the design space is huge. The choice of materials, compositions, doping, size, shape, you really want a design tool that handles those kind of things. So that's the goal with NEMO 3D. We use SP and D orbitals. We worked really hard on fitting those orbital parameters to bulk systems so we can properly model these material properties. And then we're computing mechanical strain in the system. And we have developed efficient parallel algorithms to look at eigenvalues and eigenvectors on these systems. And then we have a prototypical graphical interface as well. So the point is that we can do realistic material description at the atomic level, and it enables us to do realistically extended devices. Right? So here's a scaling curve that I like to show. What we've demonstrated is going up to 52 million atoms on a machine that has 128 cores available, basically scaling linear. 52 million atoms corresponds to roughly 100 nanometer on its cube. Right? You take 100 nanometer, 100 nanometer, 100 nanometer, and I can NEMO 3D can calculate the electronic structure in such a system. And we can do this for quantum dots, nanowires, and quantum computing devices like impurity devices, etc. Now, how do you visualize a system like that? We have built a visualization toolkit, and that visualization toolkit is actually a baseline of what you see on the NanoHub. Here's a couple of visual samples. This is an excited state in a quantum dot. And actually, if you decompose it into its S and D contributions, you see that the individual contributions can be orthogonal, which is not what you expect normally in an effective mass or continuum approach. So it's kind of interesting to see that. And as I mentioned, that's the baseline for our NanoHub Viz server that we call NanoViz. So what I'd like to do next is talk about a little bit about band structure basic. I try to give you an idea of why we're doing this, and then I'll talk about atomistic alloy disorder in quantum dots, in bulk, in nanowires, and then I'll give you a brief overview of what nanohub.org is all about and how we put this into the hands of people with problems to solve. So normally you think in terms of quantum mechanics and optical transitions in a free atom. That's probably where you learned quantum mechanics as such. You look at a hydrogen atom or a sodium atom, that's how you learned about S and P orbitals and that there's discrete states and that light spectrum is discrete. And then you might have learned that as you put these atoms together and bring them closer into a solid, you have something called bands that develop, right? These bands talk to each other. And in there, you really build a solid, and you can think about transport and things like conductivity and mobility make sense. In that sense, on the top, we generally have some physics, and on the bottom right, when we have a solid, we think about devices. And these, within these bands, electrons are supposed to move freely. All right, so let's review a little bit that from a very simplistic point of view. Let's think about a layer of blue atoms and a layer of yellow atoms. And they're different, so their, say, conduction band is differently aligned in energy, right? So what happens when you bring them together and you could grow, say, yellow atoms on top of blue atoms and maybe make the spacing slightly different? What you have is misaligned bands, right? That's one way of thinking about it. And then you can say, well, let me forget about these Coulombic core potentials, right? I'm just kind of start to neglect those. And I'm just going to start drawing straight lines through it. And I'm going to forget about all that stuff where that came from. And then I start drawing just a heterostructure like this. And in this heterostructure, I can now compute again eigenstates of the system that have ground states and excited states. And maybe I even ignore the symmetry and I draw these straight lines like this. And what you have is basically new artificial atoms, so to speak, in this layer. And now you can talk about interesting things to do on the engineering side. You can have photon absorption. You can have photon emission. You have quantum tunneling. And that maps into devices like detectors, lasers, and logic and memory devices. Right? So it's almost like you have a new toolbox to play in. And this research has been going on since the 70s, when first these devices were proposed. And the NeMo 1D tool that was mentioned really addresses transport, for example, through these resonant tunneling diodes. So the question now is, what happens in three dimensions? This was sort of a 1D picture, electronic structure in a 1D picture. Now, say you have an indium arsenide quantum dot that is embedded in gallium arsenide. You might compute a ground state of the electrons that sort of circle like an S-like ground state. And the question now is, what if these atoms in here, in the indium arsenide quantum dot, are not nicely ordered? What if it's an indium gallium arsenide quantum dot where there's some sort of disorder? So you might have one slice through the quantum dot looks like this, and another quantum dot at the same slice might have just different disorders, right? So even if experimentalists would be able to create these quantum dots perfectly identical in size and shape and place them perfectly onto a substrate, they will probably not order the alloy on the inside, right? So there will be device fluctuations from device to device. So the question now is, does it matter? So how would people normally go about doing this? Well, the typical approach would be called virtual crystal approximation. What people there do is they take sort of an average effect where they take an average atom, the indium gallium atom, and they average out that fluctuation. Okay? And if you do that, you will get a certain answer, but it completely neglects that there is fluctuations at the interface, and it raises questions, what is this interface actually? And it just replaces that, right? Everything looks smooth. So you can imagine that on the nanometer scale, that should matter. The question is how much? All right, so let's look at that. There is quantum dots people have measured and built. And in this was around 1998 or so. Rosa Leon at JPL measured around 34 millielectron volt fluctuations on the optical absorption. And in her experiment, of course, she had also device size fluctuations, right? She didn't control very well the size and the height, so that's in there as well. And then there's a group around Bimberg in Berlin. They claim to have better control of their devices, and they measure around 20 millielectron volt fluctuation. All right, so what can we do? What we can do is simulate an ensemble of these kind of quantum dots and look at the different effects that we see. Before I describe that in more detail, I like to talk about the bond length distribution that you see in the material indium gallium arsenide. Normally, as a first glance, you might think that if you have an alloy like this, that if you ramp up the indium concentration from 0 to 1, as shown on the plot on the bottom right, that the bond length distribution is sort of a linear thing, where you start out from a pure gallium arsenide-like bond and end up in an indium arsenide-like bond, and it's linear. But experiments have shown that that is not the case. There are gallium arsenide-like bonds and indium arsenide-like bonds, and there's two types of bonds in this system. So this is the lines in blue and in red are what the NeMo simulator gives, and if we model that system, we will see effects of these two different like bonds in the system. All right. So let's look at this prototypical system. Let's take a quantum dot like this and march through it along this axis and look at the conduction band edge. In an effective mass type world, we would think that there is a conduction band edge of the gallium arsenide and then the indium gallium arsenide band edge, and then again gallium arsenide. And for the holes, you would expect that you see gallium arsenide and then indium gallium arsenide, and they should split because of the strain that's in the system. But either way, you would expect that there is confinement for the electrons in the top left, and there is confinement for the holes in the top right. Now, if you do the following experiment, you march along this line through the device here, and you stop at, say, every arsenic atom along that line and look at its four neighbors and look at the distance and look at the type of neighbors and say, okay, I'm going to consider you an infinite cell and I'm going to repeat you. Then I can compute a band structure for that tiny cell, right? And then I march to the next arsenic atom and I look at its environment and say, where's my conduction band? Where's my valence band? Where's my heavy hole? Where's my light hole band? If I do that for the conduction band, what I see is that I see two different types of bonds. There's an indium arsenide-like bond and there's a gallium arsenide-like bond, okay? And the indium arsenide-like bonds are pushed up from their bulk value of roughly 0.7 to 0.2, which makes sense. And, sorry, from 0.6 to 1.2. And the gallium arsenide-like bonds are pushed higher in energy because they're being compressed. So this looks a little bit more complicated, and the image to take away is what you thought was a smooth conduction band edge, a smooth bottom of a quantum well or a particle in a box that you're used to in calculating quantum mechanics being flat is all but flat. Okay? So shortly I'll show you what happens with that. Now, for the holes, things are even more complicated because you have the light hole and heavy hole type bands, and then they're indium arsenide-like and gallium arsenide-like. So the whole hole bottom band or the top of the valence band looks really messy, okay? What you thought was a really clean system isn't really all that clean. All right, so does it matter? Let's look at it. So if you took the VCA approach and smoothed everything out, you would get a nice wave function that is S-like. And here you go. This is a different graphical presentation where this is a 3D presentation and the bottom left is a slice through the center. Now, if I take a sample that has a certain disorder in it, I get a rather disordered system like this. Okay? It kind of still looks S-like, but it's rather messy. If I take a different incarnation, just different placement of atoms, I get yet a different eigenstate. Again, it's going to look different. And also, its eigenenergy with respect to the middle one is different by some 3 millielectron volt. Now you might say, well, Klimek, that's nice. You've shown me two samples. Is that statistically significant? Maybe you grabbed the extremal ones or you got lucky or something, right? So we ran some 500 different quantum dot samples like this and looked at the valence band. And the valence band shows roughly 1 millielectron volt sigma around a mean. And the conduction band shows 1.4 millielectron volt. And the gap shows 2.3 millielectron volt. And notice that the gap is roughly the sum of the standard deviations of the valence and the conduction band edge. So why is that? Because they're correlated. When the conduction band goes up, the valence band goes down and the other way around. So the standard variations also add together. All right. So in this case, we've only looked at purely atomistic disorder. That means for each indium atom or gallium atom, we threw the dice, and you're so much percentage going to be indium or gallium, right? There's also a very simple way in NEMO 3D where we can check on clustering. What happens if there's more a little bit more of a cluster of indium arsenide, and then there's a cluster of gallium arsenide? And the easy way for us to check that is by throwing the dice for unit cell of 8 atoms. So I'm going to march through my structure, and for all 8 atoms in that cell, I'm going to declare that cell of 8 atoms. You're going to be indium arsenide or gallium arsenide. So I'm going to throw the dice for a bigger type system. And so I showed you the plot on the top in blue. It's now repeated in the second row, where it's in dark blue, and the light blue now is, as you see, much broader, and the valence bands are shifted up a little bit. Okay, so clustering makes the noise go broader, which kind of makes sense, and it narrows the band gap a little bit. Okay? All right. So the question now is, why does the noise increase? So we're going to look at the similar correlations between the pure atomistic noise and the cell-oriented noise. And we can ask ourselves, is there something else? Is there concentration fluctuations? And indeed, if we just throw the dice and say we want to have 60% indium, we're not getting exactly 60% indium, right? We're not fixing that. We don't have control over that. So there is noise over that. But if you try to correlate these eigenenergies of, this, say, the conduction band edge against the indium concentration, there's not a whole lot of correlation there. It's not like the samples that have more indium have a higher gap and the samples that have less indium have a lower gap or something like that. There is no correlation there. So it's really the internal noise that makes it fluctuate larger and vary the gaps. Okay? All right, so here's sort of the answer to the question we had. So in the experiment, people saw somewhere between 20 and 30 millielectron volt fluctuations. In the numerical experiments, we can see sort of 1 to 5 millielectron volt. And of course, again, the experiment had size fluctuations as well, which I didn't consider in this example yet. So those are going to be more important, obviously. But at least if you could control experimentally the size and the shape, you would still be stuck with the internal noise of the system. And if you wanted to build a really silent laser that it doesn't fluctuate a whole lot in this ensemble, maybe you want to stay away from alloys, right? Okay, so I don't know. All right, so next I want to talk about bulk a little bit before I go into another nanostructure. Now, I showed you an example for quantum dots where atomic disorder mattered. So let's look at bulk one more time. Similar picture. The question is, now if fluctuations are important in on the nanoscale, how big do you have to make a bulk structure that these fluctuations go away? So and how do you capture this disorder? What I can do is do a supercell calculation, where I basically repeat a unit cell larger and larger and do it infinitely and do that over a range of, say, aluminum concentration against and measure the band gap. All right? So in blue and red here on the top left, you see the experiment and our random alloy simulations. And in red, you see the standard VCA approach. Now, material scientists have developed methods that are better than VCA. And they will say, well, you shouldn't use that, right? But I don't want to implement projections onto the bulk system. I would like to use local descriptions of atoms and achieve bulk without modifying anything, because then I can also go back and stay small and kind of hope that I'm doing the right thing on the small scale. All right? So in VCA, the gap is too large and the fluctuations aren't really taken care of. And what I want to look at is now is I'm going to grab a 20% aluminum case here that is highlighted here. And I'm going to look at results that consider configuration noise and concentration noise. And I'm going to look at a clustering. So the final result, really, for the system that has the largest noise is I'm going to, if I track the band gap now as a function of system size, asking how many atoms do I need to have in the supercell, you see something interesting. Number one is that the average value of the band gap is non-monotonic. It goes down first, and then it climbs back up. And notice the number of atoms in the system here. I'm going up to 1 million atoms in this system. So for me, this function starts to be looking like bulk at 100,000 atoms, right? So to me, that's where bulk starts. 100,000 atoms for this particular configuration, this particular device or a structure is roughly 12 nanometers on a cube. All right? Now, this is taking the extremal case of clustering, of et cetera. If you're not that noisy, you might get away with smaller atoms, atom counts. But the point is that I want to make is that typical ab initio calculations sort of stop at 100 atoms. All right. The point is these calculations are very sophisticated, very strong, and some of them even get the band gap right. But they will only sample one or two or three or some of these slots here on this vertical axis. And their result will be quote-unquote right, but looking at the bigger picture, they can't sample the whole space. And really, they couldn't give you the answer for bulk. But what that means is there is going to be large fluctuations on that length scale of, say, 10 nanometers, and the placement of atoms and the details matter. That's the take-home message. All right, so that's sort of a side route into bulk. Now let's look again into nanowires, and let's look at ideal wires first, and then alloyed wires, and then silicon germanium, core shell wires, and then a charge self-consistency, something that has to do with real devices. All right, so here is an experimental result from a group in 2003 where they looked at a silicon nanowire where the diameter is roughly 2 nanometers. And let's look at a comparison on a 2 nanometer 001 wire, which is different than this direction here, but for purposes of just displaying, we'll just consider a 001 wire. What people do is they look at a dispersion along the wire axis, and they plot something like this, what you see in the center of the chart here. And they also plot, us included, compute transmission coefficients through this device, where there's step-like transmissions. And the best way to look at this is actually turn the transmission around and look at it at the same energy scale as the center plot. And what you see is basically for every band that you have, you turn on the transmission coefficient of 2, and you have step-like behavior. And when a band goes away, you have a dip. Right? Right here, there's a band that goes away. So every band corresponds to a channel for transport through this wire. All right. So here's sort of the highlight with that. This was for a perfectly ordered gallium arsenide wire, or in the experiment that was silicon. We'll deal with gallium arsenide for argument's sake. Now, what happens if you throw in aluminum? You would get an aluminum gallium arsenide wire. The question is, what does it matter that there's local disorder? And how would you treat it? So again, normally people would treat this by sort of averaging out the aluminum and the gallium into some VCA-like aluminum-gallium atom, which basically means you have smoothed out any local disorder, right? All right. So what happens if you do that? Let's start from a smoothed out VCA solution and compute a dispersion of this wire and compute a transmission coefficient. So for each band edge, you're getting a nice step. And the more bands you have, the more conduction you have through the structure. Now let's look at a truly alloyed wire and throw in the disorder. We have a way to pull out an approximate supercell calculation. And number one is we see that the gap gets smaller, just like in bulk. And you see in the transmission things that don't look steps-like anymore. It's not a clean-cut channel anymore. It's even looking like little resonances here. So what does that mean? So one way to look at that is march through the wire, as seen on the bottom left, and compute for each slice of this wire the effective band edge. Assume that each slice of that wire would be infinitely periodic and compute where's the conduction band, where's the valence band. And then plot that, and what you see is sort of a very jaggedy line. Again, the bottom of the conduction band wouldn't be flat. It is, in a sense, even though it's smoothed out over the slice, it's still not smooth along the wire. And if you superpose a local density of states that you can compute in that structure, you find actually localized states in there. So it's well known in physics that if you have a 1D system and disorder it, you have localization. Well, it kind of pops out of this atomistic simulation for free. It's not like I stuck it in or built it in. Somehow it just comes out for free. And voila, actually, it's exactly at the same energy as you saw that resonance. So it's like you see resonantly enhanced tunneling through a structure like that because you have localized states. So if you do the same thing for silicon germanium, which is a more interesting alloy compared to aluminum gallium arsenide, things are way more complicated because you have an indirect gap material, you have various delta valleys in there, and it's rather messy. And we can do similar things where we can extract local band edges, and we can extract unfolded band edges and extract effective masses of this wire. But the upshot of that is it's a very noisy system, and you'd probably have to go to larger cross sections to get away from localization. All right, so now let's look at silicon germanium core shell wires. People are interested in building these. They can actually build them. This is Charles Lieber's group, and we helped them explain some of their experimental data. So here's a silicon core with a germanium around it. If you just took that and left the silicon unstrained and strained the germanium to the silicon, you get a certain band edge diagram or a band structure, and you can compute some device characteristics from it because you have now the velocities of the carriers that move along that device. But if you relax the structure like this, with even just a simple Keating model, you get a dispersion that's significantly different. And therefore, the velocities of the carriers in that device are significantly different. So your carrier transport will be significantly different. Now, what's important to understand with real devices is that you also need to do electrostatics of these devices. They are not in vacuum. You can't just get carriers in magically and pull them out somewhere. There's gates around them. There's source and drains. So what we're building right now is something for experimentalists where they can look at a 2D cross-section of a relatively complicated device, maybe all the way gated all the way around, or even triangular devices, or an embedded nanowire with a real gate, like or a FinFET, and calculate the electrostatics in this system. And that's important because fringing fields go way outside of that central atomistic area that we're interested in. It's important to capture that. And the question is now, how do you do that? Do we need a 2D or 3D Poisson solution? Because, I mean, so far in my presentation, I've said it's got to be atomistic. It's got to be atomistic. How can you get away with a 2D solution like that? So the thing to keep in mind here is that we have typically a zinc blended lattice. And if we look into this lattice from the top, we have a 2D projection. Then we can insert some phantom atoms like that and get a typical rectangular grid that we can discretize very nicely. But what we have done is we have introduced a whole bunch of nodes where, in principle, there is no charge sitting there, right? I mean, we've introduced artificial nodes and we claim that there's going to be charge there. And does it matter? So there's real atoms and sort of fake numerical atoms that you have to deal with. And it turns out for the devices we looked at, physically, it makes almost no difference if you spread that charge out or not. Basically, a Poisson equation is a low-pass filter. So anything fluctuating very highly, you're gonna filter out. And what that helps us with is that the Poisson solution runs a factor of 300 faster, which is kind of nice, and then we could have a tool that we can offer to people that they almost run interactively rather than running a simulation for a day. All right. I want to highlight one more item on this charge self-consistency. Normally, we think of a dispersion as a material property, right? You have silicon has a certain effective mass, it has a certain band gap, and that has a certain dispersion, and you're done, right? After that, the material works is done, at least for an electrical engineer. Now, we know that for these wires and field effect transistors, there's also now a new dispersion along the transport channel. So it's a little bit more complicated than the bulk dispersion. But we normally say, okay, now give me the geometry, give me the material, and we're done. But it's actually more complicated than that. Now, it also depends on the filling of these states, on how these states are moving. So the point here is at the low gate bias, where you have barely any charge in the channel, the dispersion might look as shown in the top left. If you ramp up the gate bias and actually have charge enter the system, the dispersion actually changes. You see that the degeneracies change. And actually, if you look at those highlighted states in blue, they have moved down in energy. So the key is, the filling of the states actually modifies the dispersions. We can't think of that material as being independent of the charge it contains now. All right? So it's not a rigid shift. It's the central band shift down. And that is partly due because under low gate voltage, the charge might be centered in the nanowire. For higher gate voltages, it actually likes to confine itself into the edges, which is something experimentalists have observed. Right? So you got to be able to model that. And if you don't include this charge self-consistency effect, you're going to be off by some 20%, which is a reasonable fluctuation if you were to do device design and modeling. Right? All right. So finally, I'd like to conclude my talk on something called nanohub.org. So what is this all about? Nanohub is about online simulation, where people can work on a variety of different tools and utilize them, and a whole lot more. There's tutorials and seminars. There's research seminars. There's even podcasts of these things. We have some 4,000 people downloading podcasts of these. And there's learning modules that put together these tutorials, these online seminars, together with the tools and try to train students on these tools in what we call learning modules. And there's complete sets of courses on there as well. Supriyadatta's Quantum Transport, for example, is on there as well. All right. Now, I mentioned this calculation of cross-sections of nanowires that's being implemented right now in the Band Structure Lab. Currently, you can look in Band Structure Lab at nanowires and ultra-thin body FETs and in bulk dispersions. You can look at these unit cells, and very soon you will be able to calculate capacitance versus gate voltage and current versus gate voltage type calculations, which we can then give to experimentalists who can start to analyze the experimental data. What you can do is you can look at different geometries. And just as a highlight, since we rolled this out in June of 2006, we have over 900 people that used this tool that ran some 4,000 simulations. To give you a little bit of an idea about where NEMO 3D is relevant, it's part of our endeavor to overcome barriers to quantum mechanics, simulations in physics, chemistry, biology, and materials. And we want to cover atomistic to mesoscopic to systems levels. And we work in algorithms, computing, middleware, and service. We want to impact research. We want to impact education. And we want to be open, available, and usable by real users. The key is not just available. Many people put their codes up on the web and say, download it. It's really about making it usable by other people. So here's this example of NEMO. You've seen that chart before. So we can run NEMO on local machines. We can run it on the TeraGrid. We actually demonstrated NEMO scaling to 8,000 CPUs. There's very few engineering codes that can scale to 8,000 cores and run as well as NEMO does. So basically, this is a scaling curve, time versus number of cores, and what you like to see is on a log-log scale, a straight line. And this is pretty straight. We ran this on an IBM BlueJean and a Cray XT3. We use the same code, not running on 8,000 CPUs, but in a simplified version in tutorials and for teachers and try to impact education. And in fact, that's available on the net. So it's the same code running in a single S orbital approach, not all the 10 different orbitals. And it runs in seconds. And people can interactively look at quantum dots, wave functions, etc. And some over 600 people have used that in the last 12 months. All right. And also that code, not in the educational version anymore, will run on the TeraGrid for expert users. So I want to highlight a little bit more on the NEMO 3D scaling. We ran this on top 500 number 2, number 7, number 8, number 30, and number 46 supercomputer in the world in June of 2007. And basically, we scaled it, as mentioned, to 8,000 CPUs. These are machines that have heavy memory on them. So they have at least 1 or 2 gigabytes of RAM on the core. That allows us to store the Hamiltonian when we do a matrix multiply, we can store that matrix. If you have a very memory-thin machine like the IBM BlueJean, shown on the top right in green, we have to compute, recompute the matrix, because that machine has 256 meg per core. It's a factor of 10 smaller memory, roughly. And it runs significantly slower than the typical machines. It runs a factor of 4, roughly, slower than the other competitive machines. So here are the other machines that do have the memory. They roughly look the same as this one, but their blue gene is even slower still. So the take-home message to me is that if I compare this last write node of the blue gene result to anywhere horizontally, you can give me a machine that's 16 times less CPUs, and I still have the same computational turnaround. And IBM is indeed moving away from this kind of slow CPU, very well interconnected architecture to more hefty CPUs. There's a code that comes out of the department here that I'm giving this presentation. It's from Ali Strachan. He has built a nanomaterial simulation toolkit, and that has been used by over 600 people in the last 12 months. And you can do molecular views of different cells. You can look at, this is like a molecular dynamics type code. So who's using this NanoHub? Here's a map of the United States, and each little red dot shows the shows a NanoHub user. In the last 12 month, in the last month alone, we had 2.5 million web hits. In the last 12 months, we had 1 million visits. We have over 26,000 users. The way we define a user, that's a person that runs a simulation, so it's that person is logged in, or it's an IP address that is not logged in, but that spends at least 15 minutes on the site. So it's not web hits. So they have to have at least 15 minutes continuously on the site. And if they come back, we count the same IP. It's not, it's one user, so to speak. They roughly ran a 250,000 simulations, and we're represented at the all 51 of the top 50 engineering schools. That's going above and beyond. There's a tie somewhere. And we're represented at over 11% of all .edus in the nation. Now, if you consider that nano is a very small area, pun intended, 11% of all the 7,500 or so .edus is a quite significant representation at universities. If you go into Google Scholar and type in NanoHub, as in what October that we have now, it's actually you find some 200 citations on NanoHub in Google Scholar. When I did the analysis in June, I found 140, and 80 of those are from people I don't know, people that are coming out of the community that are using the NanoHub that we're not funding, we're not paying them, and they're finding that worthwhile to cite, at least. I would expect many of them use tools for the NanoHub. To make one example, here is a publication in Journal of Applied Physics. They work on channel positioning. They cite in their paper TCAT simulations using SHRED or ISE were used. And SHRED is a tool we have on the NanoHub. And I want to make a strong point here now. We've had SHRED on the NanoHub since at least January of 2001. And what I'm showing here are the monthly users of this tool. So roughly you can see 10 monthly users on average, a little bit of growth, and then a couple of spikes, which mean classroom usage. Somebody's assigning a homework assignment to their classroom, and suddenly a lot of people use it. You also see that those people don't come back. They didn't raise, right? Those 50 people using it didn't come back necessarily here and sustain that tool. But you do see a phase change, right? Suddenly this something interesting happens. Why? We rolled out a new Rapture version, an interactive version. So previously what we had on the NanoHub were things I would compare to what you get from your bank. You fill out a form of where you like to have the what month you like to look at. You get a static image of your bank statement. You can't do anything with it. You can download the data maybe into Excel and work on it. That's the typical state of the art of online simulation that most people have. We replaced that with something interactive where you can interactively set up your experiment. Then you can compare results on the web without downloading the data. And that triggered a significant growth in this particular application. And I can also show you the source code downloads of this application. So monthly, we roughly had 10 people that downloaded the source that looks rather similar to the people that actually used it, which probably means they tried it on the web and then they said, okay, that's enough. I'm going to download it and install it myself. Except for those poor guys that are doing this for homework assignments in a classroom and they don't have privileges to install software themselves, right? Unless they have their own machine. And then with the introduction of this new interactive service, basically the downloads stopped, except for the few people that want to look at the source and learn from it and maybe modify it and improve it. So the rule here is, the message to take away is, people aren't interested in installing and maintaining software. They're interested in solving problems. And they don't have that to do that anymore with the interactive applications that we have. And furthermore, we see that with all the applications that we converted from the old web forms into the new interactive forms. So the key is, a tool doesn't only need to be available. It needs to be usable. It needs to be user-friendly. And that needs to be a key element. So NanoHub has a global following now. You see the world map. Roughly 50% of the users are in the US. The rest are in the rest of the world. And we're obviously keeping people up at night. Or the other way around, where there's light on the world, there's NanoHub users. And what I'd like to conclude with is that I think we're changing the way people go about scientific computing. Where a few years back, you'd have to be an expert person to do anything on a computer. You speak your ones and zeros, and you speak your domain-specific science. And then the idea was, well, can't we harness all these resources and put them on portals and put different people on that? And most of the portals that I know don't succeed in putting different people on there. In fact, they put effectively the same people are on there. And you don't really reach out. And in many places, the portal actually gets into the way. It makes life harder. So outside of that community, people did something crazy for computational scientists. They used MATLAB, right? You can't do real computational work with MATLAB. Well, some people do, and they want to. And they connected to experimentalists, and they built a system called PUNCH, Purdue University Network Computing Hub, in 1994, and almost instantaneously had 1,000 annual users. And we added a whole lot of things, like the tutorials and online simulation, and we've grown to over 25,000 users, or 26,000 this month. And we're considered a science gateway now. What are we going to do next? We're going to build cyber communities where people not only download things and use it, but where we enable them to share things, share their compute codes, and also share their compute cycles so they can sort of offer cycles to the community. And then we're going to transfer this in other communities, build other hubs where they might share slightly different things, and then we're going to hook things together. And then you have a grid of hubs, which might be a grid that is actually functional and operational for real users. So with this, I want to summarize the NanoHub. It is about online simulation. It has courses, tutorials, seminars, learning modules. It has a collaboration environment, has real users. And I'm going to invite you to become an uploader. Put your meetings there, put your content there, and really have impact, right? That's what it is about. This is a venue that allows you to reach literally thousands of people. So with that, I'd like to conclude my presentation and maybe take questions. So we have, I would argue that most tools are serial tools and they execute fast. We have a couple of parallel tools that require some 5 to 20 to 30 CPUs and they execute in parallel. Some of those tools are being dispatched to the teragrid Some of the tools are dispatched to the Open Science Grid, so we leverage community compute resources. The NanoHub has a TerraGrid allocation, and we're just in the process of really utilizing that and having the grid stable enough so we can actually submit things there and have some strong belief the results come back. Because the end users are not computational scientists that know how to find the back door and make this work. So it has been mostly a reliability issue on connecting to those grids than a application specific issue. So we're going more and more towards heavy duty computation being launched out of a friendly user environment. So for example, Abinit will run, and other electronic structure codes will run through the NanoHub.
I have a question about who's the gatekeeper for the quality of the content?
Okay. I always get that question. Right. So let me, so the, there is, we don't want to have a formal gatekeeper. Mm-hmm. What we do want to do is have people that are known in the community and have a reputation put up their tools, and each tool has to have a couple of scientific papers with it that sort of verify that's what this tool does. And each tool should have some first-time user guide so you can kind of teach people on how to use this tool. So that's as much quality control as we want to put in there from our end. And then from the user end, there is things like usage numbers. Good tools will be used. Bad tools won't be used. We have a sort of Web 2.0 rating system where people can rate content and they can write down comments. And the good stuff will bubble up to the top on searches. The bad stuff won't. So we'd rather be community-driven and user-driven and have users decide on how good something is rather than us having sort of having the academic gatekeeper up front. So I'm not a believer of these allocation proposals that if you know what you want to simulate, write me a 5-page proposal and I tell you yes or no whether you get to use my computer or not. I don't like that idea. I mean, I think computation should be pervasive. It shouldn't be the thing that that is the limiting factor. It's the science, the understanding that should be the limiting factor, and we need to teach people. So the analogy I draw is, you know, we're teaching people how to drive. We teach them to driving school, quite short in the U.S., quite expensive and long in Germany. But at the end, we still have some tens of thousands of fatalities on the streets. We're not going to outlaw cars because we have these fatalities. We're not going to stop deploying tools that could be misused or results could be misinterpreted and outlaw those tools. I think those tools should be there and they become pervasive and then people learn how to use them wisely and stupidly.
For the first part of the presentation, when you show this nano dot structures with the random distributions of atoms, did you consider, or maybe I missed it, did you include, say, vacancies into the system or interstitials?
Nope.
Because in real materials, you even have equilibrium distribution of these defects. And of course, particularly in light emitting devices, you can fix these defects when they qualize some form, say, for example, dislocations, they can become a real problem in the performance of it. Is it
right.
Easy or is it?
So, in the tight binding method that I use, we can do impurities reasonably well. We haven't really learned yet on how to do dangling bonds. So, in the systems I considered, they are relatively lightly strained, so the indium-gallium arsenide in gallium arsenide, or indium arsenide in gallium arsenide, and the experiments seem to show that all these dots are optically active, so there aren't a whole lot of impurity states in them or interstitials in them. So that seems to be sort of the backdoor answer towards, I should be doing it, but I'm not.
Okay, now in alloys, you do have compositional correlations between neighboring atoms.
Right.
And they aren't really randomly distributed.
Right.
And I'm guessing that there's a way to introduce that into
the right. So if I had, I mean, that's why I'm interested in working with material scientists that can help me develop a growth model of correlations between these islands or neighboring atoms. I mean, all I could do was the simple, stupid thing, let's just say it's clustering within a unit cell. I know that that's not right, but at least it's better than not doing it at all. Or it's at least showing me it's worthwhile looking at some of clustering and that there is an effect. Okay.